take a roll call, at least at the present time, in deference to great numbers of the committee who aren't here yet, but I think most of them will be. The agenda today is to finish up the overview at the Department of Public Works.
Safety.
I mean, public, excuse me. There isn't even a Department of Public Works.
No.
Yeah, the overbuilding. But as you say, Department of Public Safety. And again, because the State Affairs Committee has uniform rules of jurisdiction over that committee, and because we're obliged to have those guests in the judiciary room, I'd like to turn the gavel over to Chairman Hovey.
Thank you. Well, we'll turn the meeting over again to Commissioner Sundberg, and you can call up people that we didn't get to last week.
Yes, Madam Chairman, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as a continuation of the briefing to the committees about the Department of Public Safety. And what I thought I would include today, I want to first introduce Colonel Robert Red Henderson, Director of Fish and Wildlife Protection. He was not here with us. He was in Washington, D.C. last time we met, and Lieutenant Seibel handled it, so you know what the colonel looks like. The first gentleman on the call today is Special Assistant to the Commissioner, Terry Hansen, to give you a brief description of the contract jail program that we administer to the Department of Public Safety. He may testify also in some of your committees. Mr. Hansen?
Thank you, sir. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, the contract jail program is a program which provides 174 beds or 63,500 person days for state charged persons in 17 communities in the state of Alaska. The statistics that we have show that 17% of all of the days served last year were on by conviction. The majority of the time spent in these facilities is pre-trial, pre-arraignment, and short sentences. It's basically a pass-through program. The money's come to the Department of Public Safety, and with the exception of the administration, the monies are passed through for the operation of the facilities and the local communities. It's basically the program. Do you have any questions?
Just quickly, do you have certain standards that, are you in the driver's seat as far as the conditions under which prisoners are held in these contract jails? Can you say, no, that sanitary situation is too bad, we're not going to contract with you, type thing?
Yes. It's laid out in the contract, which has been approved by Department of Law. We attempt to adhere as close to the Department of Corrections standards as we possibly can. It's obvious many of the smaller communities do not meet the criteria of a state-owned corrections program. So that's why we try and hold the number of days people serve time in these facilities to a minimum. It serves a good purpose for 5, 10, 15-day sentences where we do not have to ship the person from, say, Kotzebue to Nome or Anchorage or Bethel, and they can be closer to their families and homes, and in some cases, we put out a work release if the court so ordered.
We're not talking here about the contract you have with halfway houses, are we? I mean,
that's no, we have nothing to do with that.
Thank you,
Madam
Chair.
Is this a program that could be used to alleviate some of the pressure and places where they have a lot of DWIs and so forth? Are you looking into that?
That is what we are doing right now. We are taking up much of the slack that would put a greater pressure on Department of Corrections. As I stated earlier, in FY84, with the small jail contracts logged 51,292 person days.
I just didn't know where these 17 communities were.
I have a list of the communities if you would like them right out.
And I was just curious whether they are in some of the bigger cities or is it just a small
They're area? Small communities, Cordova, Dillingham, Haines, Homer, Kodiak, Kotzebue, North Slope, Craig, Co-op, Petersburg, etc.
Any other questions?
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you.
Madam Chairman, the Director of the Division of Fire Prevention, our Fire Marshal, Mr. Sam Neal. The Director, Sam?
The Commissioner, well, Chairs and members of the Committee. I'm Sam Neal, the Director of Fire Prevention, and more commonly called the State Fire Marshal. To give you just kind of brief overview of our division, we're in a division of fire prevention. We have three regions in the state. I have one regional office in Fairbanks, one in Anchorage, and one here in Juneau. My office is in Anchorage. We're in the Troopers Headquarters building there on Tudor Road. We basically have 8 field deputies, 3 regional supervisors, 1 public education coordinator, 1 fire protection engineer, and the rest personal support staff of 8 employees. Our basic statutory responsibilities within the Department of Public Safety is to promote and develop ways and means of reducing the losses of fire and minimizing the impact of fire-related activity in the state. Basically, we have 4 primary programs that we have addressed to that rather broad mandate. One of our programs is code enforcement, and that program has 2 aspects. One is reviewing new construction plans of buildings prior to constructions, and the purpose being to get the buildings built to the life safety codes at the time of their construction. And our next program in that code enforcement involves a building inspection program of existing facilities to determine their compliance with the life safety code. That program pretty much generally takes up 1/3 to 40% of our man hours and personnel. Our next in program is fire inspection, and we do that with a twofold purpose again. One is to affix calls to fires so that we might direct our public education, that we might direct the benefits learned from what we can understand about the cause of fires in a preventive type nature. And the next reason for our investigation is we work with the Alaska State Troopers, other local law enforcement officers, and our office probably is a technical aspect primarily enforcing those statutes against arson. And again, we work with those other law enforcement and the local fire departments around the state in those 2 programs. Our third program is that of public education, and we feel that we try to put as much emphasis and devote as much of our resources as we can in a preventive nature. We primarily serve as a technical assistance to local communities, the BPSO program, to the local fire departments, and also put on statewide media campaigns and trying to reach the public and educate them on the fire statistics and on ways and means what citizens can do to prevent fires. That's the basic primary synopsis and responsibilities that we have in the population.
Anyone have a question? I want to ask, do you have enough staff to get around and do all this checking on the building and so forth? Is it adequate?
We have prioritized our inspection program. Our jurisdiction, we've deferred the inspection authority to those communities that have opted to do their own. And right now, our Anchorage, the municipality of municipality of Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. Our jurisdiction resides in all the other areas besides those. With our adoption about a year ago of a high priority inspection policy, we have limited our inspection and the basic thrust of our inspection code enforcement to those places of assembly and high occupancy low type places. The pre-FAR plan part of our code enforcement, so we do plan review all buildings, no matter any commercial building that's a triplex or above falls within our jurisdiction. We don't go into duplexes or single family homes. We have no jurisdiction anywhere in the state. But in those commercial buildings and those others, with our high priority inspection policy, where we're only looking at those where a greater number of people are together, I think we're doing pretty an adequate job in addressing those personnel and area wide.
Well, I asked that question. I noticed in Fairbanks, Michigan, I had to sit off a building in Fairbanks that had been in violation of the fire code for 24 years or something.
That building is in the jurisdiction of the city,
yeah.
And the city had been trying for years to get the state to respond, and I think most seriously since 1976. They had asked us if we would assist them in going through and doing a joint effort, and that's where
that's what finally
get the news. Yes.
Thank you very much. Anyone else? Thank you very much, Mr. Neal. Before you have another person, Representative Grunberg had a question of Mr. Hansen. He didn't get that.
Mr. Hansen? I'm sorry. I forgot to ask a question. Looking at some of the private contracting services, I've received some indication that male people would be interested in providing that for halfway houses or people pre-release. One contractor who provides such services in another state lists, among other purposes of such services, the protection of material witnesses in cases. What is your feeling about the use for that purpose as well?
In local community jails?
Well, these were not in local community jails. This was specifically in a county in Nevada that they were doing this. He provided services, the same kind of services I think that they're thinking of wanting to bid for in this state.
I think it's an excellent approach for low priority type misdemeanors or witnesses or whatever type of security is needed for the state or for a court case, to put them out to in a motel style setting. It's my understanding that there is a move afoot to look into the approach you're speaking of.
You don't think the two uses would be particularly incompatible, but could be done together?
Yes, definitely. And it'd be a great cost saving. I'm sure the cost of contract jails, which I failed to mention, was $61 per day,
mm-hmm.
which is considerably less than other areas.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chairman, the director of the largest division within the public Department of Public Safety, Colonel Mike Kolobowski, director of the State Troopers. Colonel Kolobowski.
Good afternoon.
Well, first off, I'd like to give you a little background about the Alaska State Troopers as far as we're authorized 336 positions. Our division is classified for field enforcement into five geographic locations, headquartered A detachment. We identify them by letter. A detachment would take in the whole southeastern area. B detachment with headquarters in Palmer takes in the Anchorage, Palmer, Glen Ellen, Valdez, as well as up the Parks Highway as far as Hurricane goes. C detachment was headquartered in Soldotna, is responsible for Kodiak Island as well as the Aleutian Chain. D detachment is on the whole west coast, headquartered in Bethel, takes in the Nonococcus area as well. And finally, E detachment, which is headquartered in Fairbanks, takes most of the northern region from Paxton north on the highway, the whole Alaska highway, and all the way up to Barrow. Our two other subdivisions would be our Criminal Investigation Bureau, which is a pool of highly trained and highly skilled investigators which concentrate on the more detailed and complex crimes. I'll address that particular function a little later in We have a judicial services unit as well. The largest makeup is in the Anchorage area. We have 22 officers, state troopers assigned to this function. We have smaller units in the major areas, Fairbanks and Juneau. It's the state trooper's statutory responsibility to move prisoners that are in state custody as far as to and from court. We're also saddled with the responsibility of maintaining control when they have to go to doctors, to dentists, for further court appointments. And I believe in researching this particular function as an example, in the Anchorage Judicial Services for fiscal year 84, we moved 27,177 prisoner moves. And that was for a variety of court, medical, within facilities. And the Anchorage area has a court-ordered Clery decision, which is a cap on the amount of prisoners. This causes some consternation with the prison officials because of the fluctuating population. When they have to be moved around the state or around the communities, the troopers are responsible. Now, we have been looking at ways to address that particular problem. Corrections, the Department of Corrections, who at one time transferred most of their in-house prisoners, but several years ago we had an individual escape and ultimately ended up killing a police officer. And Governor Hammond at that time transferred the responsibility over to the state troopers. There has been increased training in corrections, increased awareness of the large demands that are on the state troopers for this type of service, and Commissioner Sundberg, I believe, as well as Commissioner Rendell are exploring the possibility of going back to the minimum security. As the Commissioner mentioned, we have instituted a TV arraignment type of approach in Fairbanks, which I think is going to be a boon as far as saving equipment, transportation, and man hours down the road. It's in the pilot stages in Fairbanks. We tried Fairbanks primarily because they have one jail, one court, and we really had to get the cooperation of the court system, the whole criminal judicial system, with the attorneys and everyone else. Initially, it started out for bail arraignments, but we're finding now there seems to be a little interest within the courts themselves to see that it is working good, so we may want to expand it to some minor court hearings. So the potential is really unlimited. We're looking also at Juneau and Anchorage in this year's capital budget expenditures, and quite often you'll see out here that we'll have a van, maybe 13 or 14 prisoners, that will have just a couple of troopers that are responsible. And statutorily, if the person is charged with a state charge, even if it's a city police officer that arrested them, the troopers are responsible. And we usually get pretty good cooperation from the local chiefs to give us an assist because they realize what a tremendous burden this is to us. We've got a statewide narcotics program as another subdivision of the Alaska State Troopers. And this particular program, when I came in as the director in 1983, we took what I considered kind of a disjointed program. We tried to centralize it, get a central common theme with two particular goals. One, to address statewide needs that only a large organization such as ourselves would be able to address. And second, provide the kind of the technical expertise of the smaller communities so that we could not only be able to go in and help a local community that doesn't have the resources or the expertise, and I think we've been pretty successful on that particular count. As we look over our assistance with the local communities, we've helped out Cordova at their request. We stopped a major drug ring, a cocaine distribution ring, from establishing in Kodiak just through our intelligence and our undercover work in Anchorage. They were already lining up with our people to start this business in Kodiak, and we were very successful in stopping it. In the Homer area, we were very successful in drug prosecutions. Recently, over the just before the holidays this year, we ended up with 56 arrests for narcotics throughout from Haines, Craig, Ketchikan, Sitka, Juneau, and these are a result of some undercover operations jointly with the local police department's cooperation and assistance. So we feel that we've tried to address a great deal of the local needs. I think one example of the local need is that in the city of Palmer, we had an individual who was selling marijuana to kids and to everyone. It had been a pain in everybody's neck for quite some time. The chief came to us and asked us, can we lend the assistance? Well, in Anchorage, of course, we're a bigger community, and a marijuana case really isn't that isn't really a top priority. Well, we convinced the district attorney that in Palmer, that's a major consideration. We were successful in the investigation, and the district attorney picked up the ball and prosecuted. The guy got 5 years. And that problem was cleaned up off the streets. And so I think we're trying to address on the local level what the local community's needs are. Now, obviously, in Anchorage, the sale of marijuana would probably not be a high priority, given the volume of cases that are coming to the Anchorage office. So that's hopefully an example of what we're trying to do with this program. When we, I think a couple of important things with the narcotics program is when we were reorganized, we didn't get any additional people and we didn't get any additional funding. So we just, we took over, it seemed to be the message coming from the governor was, well, can you do more with less or more with the same? And early on, we evaluated our staffs and we pared down quite a few of the overhead and the administrative people, and some of our narcotics officers now were former administrative people, and some of our investigators are now in the field who used to have desk jobs. So I think we've done a good job in expanding our program without asking for a lot of additional people, a lot of additional funds. Right now, we've got 20 full-time state troopers in the statewide narcotics program. There's 9 municipal officers that are assigned to full-time narcotics enforcement. We've got 16 part-time officers. These are city police officers such as Valdez, Kenai, that are part-time to help us out as cases develop and as contacts are needed. We've established what we call major units. It's a metro concept in Anchorage and Fairbanks were our initial ones. Because of the success we were having in the direction we seem to be taking, we've entered into a new one with Juneau. We have a metro unit going in Juneau now, and that again was at no expense or no additional people from the state troopers, just by reprioritizing. We established a narcotics officer in the Matsu Valley. I was the detachment commander in the Matsu Valley for 6 years, and I really felt that we needed somebody with the expertise that the average patrolman just wasn't going to be able to get those kind of cases and develop them. And consequently, this year we were able to make 2 lengthy investigations culminating in the arrest of approximately 27 people over a long period of time. We cleaned out a couple of bars that had been really just dens of iniquity, for lack of a better word. And so I think we've made some real good progress along that line. We've also got the responsibility of the VPSO program, which is the Village Public Safety Officer program. And as most of you, I'm sure, are aware, it's a program where we have the local communities, the local villages have come forth with officers or with village members that have been taken in for specialized training and sent back to their villages. And it's under the concept of not just strictly law enforcement, but they're taught the life-saving techniques. They're taught water safety, fire combating, fire prevention techniques. The idea being that we'll have a person who can at least keep the situation from getting worse and be a little bit trained so that it'll be a focal point for the local community to be able to respond to. The troopers have tried to, number one, establish training and ongoing training for these called modular units for the troopers, as well as supervising the oversight, making sure that the work is quality work and that we're getting the actual bang for the buck, so to speak, that we're getting a return for our investment. The program has allowed us to go into the villages more so on a routine basis as opposed to the old days. The only time you saw a trooper went in when there was a crisis, and there wasn't much time for a lot of the general feel for the community, the socializing, if you will, when you're in a crisis situation. So we feel that the VPSO program has been a good thing for the village. It's been a good thing for the Alaska State Troopers in order to have someone we can rely on when we go to that particular village. We've modified the program. It probably, as the concept became developed in the first couple of years, I guess it was like the Wright brothers, will the thing fly or not? Well, it was weaving, and we got it up, and I think it's a fly, and I think it's going to be there. We've modified our reporting system somewhat so that we've got it a little bit better now. It isn't quite as cumbersome as it is. And we're looking at new ways to do things and hopefully be able to keep improving the program. But I think the basic concept is sound, and I think it's probably one of the best approaches at rural law enforcement that we've been able to come up with. I took what Representative Miller said last week. He hates reports and that, but I did want to offer this up. I prepared what I call just an annual report that I brought about 8 copies. And this thing will give you basically a breakdown of what the troopers do and even what the details of what a normal day in the life of a trooper would be, so to speak. It speaks about our Criminal Investigation Bureau, how many personnel we have, also some budget numbers, what we have this year, what we're asking for next year, and gives you an idea what the cost of a typical trooper would be in Fairbanks and a typical trooper in Anchorage. It addresses the narcotics program, and I brought some copies, and I would encourage you to take a look at it, and it may answer some questions that may come up as we go along here. I thought that I might just elaborate a little bit when you say the trooper, the duties of a trooper. Well, what do they really mean, you know? And you always hear, especially in the interior, geez, I went from Anchorage to Fairbanks, never saw a trooper. You know, what are you guys doing? You know, all off for coffee. And well, we started looking at, you know, the duties, and you think about the normal thing, okay, the patrol, what does that mean? Well, he's patrolling for a lot of things, but he's also doing the traffic enforcement. You've got the accident investigation. We've got a lot of requests for public appearances. As you get a one-man post, a two-man post, such as Cantwell, the PTA wants to talk to the fellow. The local groups want to talk to the trooper. So there's a lot of demands along that line. We've got the assist of the other agencies, sometimes welfare checks. They'll want us to go up into to a particular area and see if someone's okay or there's overdue claims. The criminal investigations, so that the misdemeanors, the felons, at least the initial stages of them. So as you see, we will have prisoner transports. Our fellows on the highway system, if they arrest a guy at Coke, we've got to ultimately put him in jail in Fairbanks, and he's going to serve some time. Well, that encompasses the Delta trooper meeting the Toke trooper, the Toke trooper or the Delta trooper then meeting the Fairbanks trooper, and those are other areas where you really can get a lot of time consumption on just bringing one fellow to jail. In the metropolitan areas, when you look at the enforcement arm, you're looking at the DWI. Now, we spend an awful lot of time and effort in this state trying to tighten up and rectify the drunk driving laws. It's taken a trooper an average of about 3 to 4 hours to process a drunk driver now. If we get one drunk driver, from the time you stop him in the Anchorage area, and by the time you get your wrecker, you take him in there, you get him videotaped, you run him on the toxalizer, and you finally fill out your reports and get him off to the jail, you're looking at about 3 hours. We've had a couple of different people from the administration, a couple of legislators that have ridden around with us from time to time, and I think that's been the one major thing that's really reached out and hit him. Geez, it takes a long time to process a drunk driver. In the old days, when we were first starting out, it wasn't uncommon on a Saturday night to pick up 5 drunk drivers. Basically, pick them up, you take them in, you run them on the breathalyzer, you make your report, and away you go. But it's become quite an ordeal. And there's a lot of safeguards into the system now, and each time it seems that the videotape has become an integral part of prosecution, and certainly the intoxilizer is certainly an integral part of prosecution. So there's an awful lot of burdens that they go on to the trooper. We looked at some cost analysis, and it's very hard because of the variety of work, but it takes the trooper approximately 15 to 20 minutes to write a traffic ticket. What we've done, when we stop the guy, and you fill out the thing, you have to take the ticket over, you have to address the court, you have to find the bail system, you have to find the points, and I dare say that most fellows that have ridden a traffic ticket, like myself, a while, when you look at all the put the carbons in, turn it over, but those are things that eat up an officer's time. So those are some examples that when you really boil it down, you know, the old thing, oh, anybody can write a ticket. Well, you can and you can't. It certainly has become quite a process, and what with the bail system, fine, that's a real nice thing, but it also leads to a lot more confusion on the officer's part, or at least a more consumption of his time. Some of the things that I think that we tried to do in the last couple of years, and I think we've been fairly successful at them, was take a look at our reorganization first and foremost, with the emphasis of getting more people back into the field as opposed to administrative jobs. We've kind of evaluated our workload and with our Criminal Investigation Bureau. When it was formed in the old days, we had a large pool of men in Anchorage, and we would respond to the various police departments as their needs came up in our own detachments. That concept, as time has went by, with revenue sharing, with a lot of the other things that have come in, a lot of our police departments now are pretty well equipped, and I don't know that we're getting quite the demands that we used to have from the smaller departments. Valdez, an example, used to be, what, about a 2 or 3 man police department all through the pipeline. Now they've got a beautiful building, a large staff, they handle most of their own. We give them just basically minimal assistance. So we reorganized our Criminal Investigation Bureau with the emphasis of putting more fellows in the field. Juno is an example. I was the captain down here for a while. We had one investigator. Now we have three. And what's happening is the sexual assault and child abuse has really become, we had, out of the three guys that we had down here, one of them is full-time in that. That's his sole responsibility to just that type of crime. So again, I have to keep qualifying, as we beefed up and distributed, that was with no additional manpower and no additional resources. Another thing that we've tried to do, and I think we've been fairly successful, Colonel Henderson and myself are close personal friends. We've been for some time. We both live in the Palmer area. And when we both got these jobs, we talked about the possibility of cross-training. Our thoughts were in a lot of the small rural areas. In the old days, we had a trooper and a fish and wildlife officer. And he had 2 houses, 2 cars, 2 salaries, and the fish and wildlife officer did his thing, the trooper did his thing. Well, our thought was if we could combine, and the fish and wildlife officers are part of the Department of Public Safety, they go through the academy. In the old days, they would separate, take some classes together, but then they would go off into the various specialized fields. Our thought was, why don't we try and draft the future fish and wildlife from seasoned troopers? So if we have a place such as, let's take Yakutat, where we have 2 officers. If we had one fellow there who could do both jobs, and I don't think the workload is going to be all that great that he couldn't do that. If we have moose hunters in the fall, maybe we'll put an additional temporary in there or something to meet the certain needs that would come up. But basically, we feel that we can be able to get more without taking away from either. No one is trying to make the brown shirts solely police officers. And we recognize that their primary mission is resource protection, but that's not their only mission. Our primary mission is criminal enforcement. But that doesn't mean that we can't assist in some areas. Now we've been very successful. Glen Allen, as a matter of fact, we have the fish and wildlife officer in charge of the post, primarily because we've had some illness and we thought, well, let's try it there. In Nome recently, we put the fish and wildlife under the command of the trooper. So we're trying this on a smaller basis and we're seeing how it's working. I think for the most part, we're getting some fairly successful results. So that's another area, I think, where we can start to realize some definite savings. And keep hopefully getting the better training and the better quality of officer that's going to serve the public. The narcotics program I addressed, I really believe that we have just a dynamite program. We found now that since 1983, we've had 2 ongoing investigations, which have been ongoing into the months. We took out a complete cocaine distribution ring. This Resic Marin was direct Colombian connection, where they were coming up with just an awful lot of cocaine. The head man, to give you an example, was sending $25,000 a month to a bank in Santo Domingo. That was his own private account. So this guy was making pretty good bucks. We found that we had a heroin operation that we ran for 3.5 months in Anchorage. Now, we didn't think we had much of a heroin problem in Alaska. We were pretty smug in our ways, figuring, well, we, cocaine and marijuana, yeah, well, what, heroin's not here. Well, heroin is here, and we address it in the manual as well, or in this publication, gives you a little more breakdown as to what took place with the heroin operation and the quantity. I've even tried to give you an idea what the cost of the street drugs are, so you'd have some idea when you're talking about what does it cost for a teaspoon or a quarter tea or things like that. So that might be somewhat informational for you. We've got a crime lab that was funded through the legislature last year, and that's under construction right now in Anchorage. It'll be right next to the department headquarters in Boniface and Tudor. We feel that this is going to be a real boon to law enforcement as far as investigations go, with the ability to process evidence now that takes a great deal of time to go back to the FBI. And we're always under time constraints now when charges are filed, and we feel that this is going to facilitate better response back to the investigators in the field. So we're very encouraged with that. Hopefully, if the creeks don't rise and everything works good, we should be online toward before the end of the summer. We're very optimistic. And Anchorage had a problem with winds this year, and they had this huge balloon over it, and the balloon keeps blowing down. They keep saying that, well, that delays them another week or two, and I'm sure puts the price up too. So we'll wait to see. But we are encouraged with the progress that's going on. Our narcotics program has had some special projects this year. We've moved into the post office. We've recognized for some time that we feel that the post office is probably the biggest distributor of drugs we have in Alaska. That's our feeling. And the post office for a long time was somewhat reluctant to admit that. But you put your 20-cent stamp on it, and, you know, rain, dark of night, sleet or snow is going to get your dope there where you're going. And it's really ironic, but that we found that in many, many cases that this was the case. So with the help of Senator Murkowski at the Washington level, we got the post office involved in a pilot project, just to take a look at it. So we had our officers trained and staked out at particular airports to profile packages that were coming in. And in a 24-day period in the summertime, we found 25 pounds of marijuana and 4 ounces of cocaine were coming through the mail. We found that 83% of the marijuana was destined for rural Alaska. We found one junior from West Anchorage High School was getting his marijuana from Hawaii through the mail. And so it was really interesting. And projecting that out just in our 24-day span, we could project that possibly as much as 380 pounds of marijuana and probably 4 pounds of cocaine would be coming into the state through the mail. So the post office people started acknowledging, yeah, hey, we do have a problem here. So we're trying to address that and trying to get better at it. But at least we're getting a response. We never had a response before.
Just got my curiosity. How do you find this stuff? You have to bring the dogs to sniff it out? Or?
Yes, sir. That's one way of doing it. We've had a lot of ways of doing it, but the dog is an integral part of it, yes. We've also became involved in a joint federal operation as far as marijuana cultivation. We're talking about the commercial crops go. And this particular year, with some training, we were able to come up with 18 raids resulted in 350 pounds of a wheat field commercial operation. The program was kind of started a little bit later than what we wanted, and we think we probably missed some of the harvest times, and I think we'll be better next year. We've concentrated primarily in the Matsu area and in the Fairbanks area. And we feel that we were successful enough that we would like to try and go back and do this again. The Fish and Wildlife officers were a big help. We trained them what to look for out in the fields and in the greenhouses, and when you find one 15 miles away in a greenhouse, that's a good clue. But through that quite a cooperation, when they're out on their routine patrols as far as, looking at the game violators and that, they're also looking for us and helping us out. So we found some tremendous cooperation between divisions, so we're very pleased with that. We've also looked at, with the various programs in the VPSO in our narcotics program that this particular year in alcohol enforcement. We've come up with the Narcotics Bureau has come up with 31 alcohol-related type crimes, and we've helped the VPSOs out to 121 cases. So we are trying to do something about importation in the villages, some of the various liquor problems that do come up. So we have tried to work with our controlled substance people have worked with the VPSO to give an understanding of some of the illicit drugs, as well as trying to bone them up on some of the alcohol laws. So we feel we're making some kind of impact and even using the VPSOs, especially in the liquor cases. So we're pretty encouraged with that. I think that when you look at where we're going next year, I feel that our budget is pretty reasonable. We haven't been asking for a great deal as far as additional people goes. We have tried to reprioritize. There'll be no new commissioned troopers requested for. I think probably the biggest section of personnel it will be whatever happens with the truck program. I think the commission moved maybe 11 people if it does come over to us. We'll have to wait and see what happens on that. A couple of the things that I would like to at least address to you that are in the budget this year that I think are important for you to at least have a grasp on We've asked for $578,200, and what we'll call, for lack of a better word, a super fund, a narcotic super fund. What we're trying to do with that is place that particular money, just earmark it, in addition to our ongoing statewide narcotics budget. If we can meet certain criteria for the development of a case, and we know that we're going to be impacted a considerable amount, we would like to be able to have that money available to us. If we don't do it, we won't need it. Now, the Resic Marin case was approximately three and a half months. That cost us $450,000. We resulted in, I believe, about 26 arrests and a large seizure of about 9 pounds of cocaine, and I guess about $85,000 to $100,000 in cash were retrieved. In the heroin operation just concluded, we ran that program at about $350,000. Now, what this does to our statewide narcotics budget is program pretty much what we anticipate will be in the normal operating cost that we're going to run across throughout the, and a little bit for small operations. When we get into a major operation where it's going to take 2-3 months, maybe even longer, we had 200 officers involved in the roundup in both of these cases because of the magnitude. We had several places to hit, we had several search warrants to execute, and several people to arrest. So we ended up with a total of 200 police officers. It was a well-coordinated and well executed. In fact, Chief Porter, after the first one, said in his 22 years in police work, it was the best planned and executed raid that he'd ever seen. But the impact to the budget, I don't believe we can sustain those kind of major operations using the normal, the budget was never designed for that.
Mike,
it wasn't too long ago that the feds were doing a lot of that. Mm-hmm. I remember some big busts in the mid-70s. And it was pretty much a federal operation. Mm-hmm. And what's the status on that? I'm sure you cooperate with the Drug Enforcement Administration, but are their activities winding down or what?
Their cooperation level, we get a lot out of those two fellas. There's a lot of, I would say that for the most part, we have addressed the problems at the statewide level because we haven't been overly encouraged, or we don't expect a great deal of shift in emphasis on the Alaska scene. What usually happens, you can just pare this down, as I talked about marijuana in Palmer, we go up here, we say we've got 9 pounds of cocaine in Anchorage, the guy in New York will say, yeah, that's terrific, I got 50 pounds, you know, so we'll see you later.
Yeah.
And Miami, New York, Los Angeles, those are the major centers where, I guess obviously prioritizing where they're at, that's where we're seeing the main thrust of the resources, the money and everything else goes. So Alaska, we have been very, very, you know, work with the feds, and we've got good cooperation, but with two agents, you're not going to get an awful lot, and I don't anticipate too much of a shift in emphasis, especially with the large problems they have in Miami, New York, and some of the major cities. So what we tried to do with looking at this Superfund, if you will, is put the restrictors on it so that the commissioner would have he would have to be convinced. In fact, when we sat down to look at Black Gold, which was the nickname of our code name of our heroin operation, we kind of projected out, okay, here's what we think we have, and here's what we think we can do. And how we ran that program, we had an undercover officer, a Fairbanks Police Department officer, who came down and assimilated into the drug subculture. Now we had to get him an apartment. We even got him a Cadillac, and he just got into the thing, and he was doing his thing with these guys. And as we started to develop and started to recognize some of the old names that kept cropping up, the commissioner and myself discussed it, tried to project it out what it would cost us, and what was it worth what we were trying to do. Well, with the amount of heroin, I believe we picked up in this thing was 4 or 5 pounds of heroin. The exact figures are in the book. And looking at the money that was involved and the tragedy that we feel is involved with this type of an operation, we felt it was well worth our expenditure of funds. And I guess you have to understand, in the Resic case, which at that time was the biggest cocaine case we ever had, that was a chance meeting by a former student state trooper. We had a student state trooper program. He went into one of these 24-hour quick stops, was having a cup of coffee, and he's talking to this drug kingpin. And that's what one thing led to another, and the guy came to us and says, hey, I can get into these guys. Well, we had never done these kind of cases before. And so when you look at it, well, what is this money buying? Well, this money buys you 24-hour day surveillance. This money buys you we're into labor contracts now. And after you work guys 16, 18 hours a day, you have to pay them. Well, in the old days, it used to be when we came out, you worked for your salary and you worked until the job was done. So we're into a serious, you have to address that problem. You're talking about personal services. You're talking about expenditure. So as we went into these two cases, we found that just our costs alone for tailing these individuals. You're talking about some high-priced characters, and I addressed some of the fellas today, and I tell you that what we ended up doing was going to Alaska Sales and Service in Anchorage, and we had an open contract with them to change cars. Now, these fellas would not go in a normal transaction. The dope would come in, they'd have one apartment they would rent. Bring the dope in, leave it there. Let's sit for a day or two, see if anything happens, nothing happens, everything is cool. And they take it from there over to another apartment. Then they start cutting it up, and they may just sit on it for a day or two, and they may not. This whole thing takes a long time. To make a normal delivery, let's say here where everybody knows in Juneau, if you're going from here to the airport to do your transaction, you'd probably end up going out to Thane, over to Douglas, changing cars, if you're a dope dealer. Then go out to the Valley, and we in Anchorage, we had the one guy one time was going to go from over in Tudor over to Mountain View. He went out to the Kinnick River Bridge, 35 miles away, sat for 2 hours, just waiting to see if anything happened. Nothing happened. So as we got into this kind of an operation, we were starting to be startled. These guys would go down a wrong way in a one-way street. They'd just stop, leave their car right in the middle of the street, jump it out, get in another car and take off. So they impound it. Doesn't mean anything to them. So we were growing up. We were learning a lot more because we're talking about guys from New York. In fact, when we went to the New York authorities, you talked about cooperation. When we finally realized who we were dealing with, this Jesus Marin was a hot number from Columbia. And when we first asked them for their assistance in New York, they told us basically, well, geez, we don't work weekends, you know, we're just kind of, so as the thing turned out, and we found out who, when they found out who we had, they said, Jesus, could you hold this thing open a few more weeks? We said, yeah, we planned this for this date, and that's what's going down. So sometimes the degrees of cooperation level with people outside varies, you know, but we ended up with many new levels of expertise and experience. And these are the kind of costs that are involved in trying to do a major operation. And what we're really trying to say is that we would like to be in a position, if we can do these things, if we can set the criteria, that we would have those kind of funds available to us. If we don't, then we don't want the money. We're not asking for additional money so we can go out and just spend it. I like to lock that money up for a rainy day. But if we can develop that type of case, we would like to be able to have that kind of resource available to us so it wouldn't impact the rest of our program.
Excuse me, ma'am.
Do you have any questions?
The money figure again.
578.2, sir.
578.
Yeah. And that's a projection based on both of our cases. And we have managed our cases right down to the gnat's knuckle, we feel. And I think that we can account for our funds where we're going. In fact, I'm really pretty proud of the administration of our program. So that's something that I was hoping that I could at least explain to you as you go along and say, well, what do they want with this? And it's just so we'll be able to run our statewide program and still be able to go after the big guy. I think after the two cases we've run, it's not a question of can we do these. We have some. The fact is, in this last heroin case, we led the authorities to Seattle. They've been trying to get this guy for 7 years. This was our Kingpin's distributor. And we were able to go down into Los Angeles and nail some of the major distributors down in Los Angeles. So little old Alaska is starting to make an impact on the West Coast just through this program. So I'm very, very pleased with the progress and the results we've made. And I think that the main thing is that we have the resource. And we've done an awful lot with our own and without asking for additional. But here's one thing after 2 years, and I think that we have a commitment to this state to try and wipe out the major dealers. And try and create the illusion, at least, or the impression that narcotics dealing in this state is a very, very risky business. And I'm hoping that we're starting to reach that point. With that, I'll close and offer any questions or anything that...
Representative Sun.
Your VPSO programmer, I think you said the number. Are you asking for any more people in that program?
No, we're asking basically for some restoration of some funding. We are not asking for additional officers right now.
But any requests for additional officers from the villages or towns or wherever would come through you?
Yes, sir.
I guess the reverse, you're not asking for any cuts either.
No, I think the commissioner...
thought I'd ask that question. I've learned here not to assume something.
Yeah. No, last year we asked for a cut because we thought we could run the program with some modifications. It turned out that our projections weren't accurate, and so we're asking for some additional funding to, probably to restore, and probably a little bit more than what we'd asked for in the past.
Representative Belcher?
You mentioned the truck program.
Mm-hmm.
How many people did you say?
I believe it's 11, sir.
And the question keeps coming up again, aren't we just exchanging one bureaucracy for another? How many people are in ATC? Well, people, and I realize this isn't a problem anymore,
sure,
but this question's been asked, and it probably will be asked in some cases.
Well, the ATC had, I think, believe five inspectors.
Had five inspectors?
Yes. And the inspectors really were saddled with an impossible task. It was five statewide. In addition to safety regulations that they were trying to inspect, they were also charged with violations of operating authority. So that, let's say the guy in Valdez was a contract carrier to carry watermelons. So he starts hauling iron, then they complain, hey, this guy's violation of his operating authority. And with five guys, they were trying to do everything. And so basically they were doing very little of anything. But they were still saddled with the responsibility, and they were still given the problem. So when we took over the program in 1977 from Weights and Measures, that was probably the first attempt to consolidate where we did the inspections, we weighed the trucks, and we did everything one-stop shopping. Now the ATC was responsible for inspections, the Weights and Measures is responsible for weighing. And so the program, as it stands now, has two different agencies. Now, the troopers have still maintained a presence in conjunction with our patrol. And I've also included in this book what we did as far as truck enforcement last year. And the numbers that we've weighed and the numbers that we've placed out of service and the types of inspections we've done. And basically, I think we've made a little bit of a presence in conjunction with our patrol effort. So whether 11 is a good number or a bad number, I guess it all depends on how you want to play with numbers. But I think what we'd be addressing would be the safety aspects, and I believe some licensing commissioner, I'm not sure about what the other requirements are, but I would be dealing primarily with safety, or that's what I would think that we would try to address. And I'm not sure that we're creating another bureaucracy, but I think that the recognition that we needed some type of safety regulations on it, or at least enforcement on the trucks, or what I think is a critical issue.
Representative
Sun. Yeah, Madam Chairman, along that line, there's in the bills that are before us now are proposed for you to take over the aviation functions that ATC had also. I guess my question was, how do you plan to handle that, and how many people would that take?
I don't know a thing about that, Commissioner.
I believe, if I could, these numbers are primarily guesstimates right now, but it looks like the 11 went up to about 16 people. If we did assume the licensing and the control and the insurance, if that's all included finally after legislative hearings and everything, I think the number is going to be about 16 or 17 to conduct it all.
That's for the aviation and the truck?
Yes, sir.
And what were you proposing to do on the aviation side?
Aviation, we were just going to license, if you will, and ensure that the insurance was on file with the state in accordance with the air taxi license and with the business they were doing. Now, whether or not the legislature even wants to move that far, that's what's being debated right now. The governor really hasn't taken a firm I read the governor's letter of transmission, and he certainly lets it open as to what the legislative body wants to do. We've made our proposal, and we're going to wait and see what the legislature wants to do.
Any other questions? Representative Taylor?
Yes, Trooper, you indicated that marijuana was, in essence, a lower profile item in Anchorage, but that in some of the more outlying areas, it became more of a higher profile item.
Yes, sir.
And because of that, you were able to do some very effective work up in Palmer.
Yes, sir.
What's your opinion of our present marijuana statute and its variations, or in the manner in which it varies from the federal law?
Well, I think my personal, and I think the department's position is I think that the marijuana law, I think the Anchorage Crime Commission addressed it. I think it should be reinstituted. I think we should develop it so we all know we're singing off the same sheet of music. You know, I arrested a guy about a year and a half, well, a couple of years ago, it's been a little longer, I've been a director now. But watch this guy, we were staking out, it's just a little story, but it's true, we were staking out the DNA that was supposedly going to rob it. So me and this other guy are sitting out there at night, it's a grocery store. Saw this guy going back and forth. He had a bag. What the heck's this guy doing? So we finally stopped him. Well, he had marijuana, and the guy just came in from outside. So I thought it was legal. I says, no, I says, you can't own it, trade it, barter it, sell it, but you can possess it if you can get to your house, you know. And so he says, this is really wacky. You're telling us, you know. So, but I think that on a personal basis, you know, I have an 18-year-old boy that when you sit down and try and converse with him, it's very difficult to stay on the line of track. Well, it's legal. Well, it's non-legal. Well, it is. Well, it isn't. Well, if you're over here, it isn't. You know, it is. Yeah, I think that we ought to be able to take the position that I think that marijuana is definitely an illegal substance. And it should be illegal. I mean, it's buy, trade, sell, but you can own it. And as I mentioned earlier today, I was just reading a story on this John Belushi. And it really hit me because here was a guy that went back when he was a senior in high school, tried his first marijuana. And his father-in-law, it turned out to be his father-in-law, told him, said, you know, you're going to kill yourself. It's going to lead to more stuff. And they laughed it off. Well, he's dead. And when he died, he was using heroin, cocaine, and everything under the sun. So I believe that, I don't know what the medical evidence will say, but I think there's a direct interrelationship. And I think that if we're going to enforce it, I think we ought to do it, and I think we ought to, you know, just have the wherewithal to say it's illegal.
Are you familiar with what the federal statutes are on marijuana?
Fairly.
Do you think that would be a viable alternative for us to adopt the same, or at least bring our law into compliance with the existing federal law on that subject?
I think we would be a lot better off. I think they would be compatible, at least would be consistent. And I think that would be a good start, sir.
Would that be of assistance to your drug enforcement division to have that type of statute?
I think it would be an assist, and I think that one of the things that we would have to realize, you would hear probably from the Department of Law, would be the overwhelming impact of additional cases would have. And I think that, at least initially, that may be true. But I think if we take a stand, and what I'm trying to do with this program here is I believe that we have to make a stand. I want to create the illusion that I don't care if you're in a three-piece suit, and you're driving your Cadillac, if you're selling dope, you got a good chance it could be an undercover officer you're selling to. And I think that until we create that illusion, and we create that idea that narcotics is not going to be tolerated in this state, we're going to be dealing with the hit-and-miss type of operation we have. I think narcotics became a very, very lucrative business and became more developed through the years, but we were basically still staying back in the horse and buggy era. And now, with the program that we have now, we're playing a little catch-up ball. But we have done a couple of good jobs, and I think that I think we can make some more of an impact on it. But I think that if we can comply with what the federal statute is, I think we'll be in good shape.
One other question.
Representative Taylor?
Thank you.
The other question is, as concerns identification and location of runaway children in general, would you comment upon the assistance that it might be to your department to have fingerprints available and photographs?
Okay, well, one of the things that we have tried to do, and that was one of the things I'm glad you mentioned that, we have formed a missing persons bureau within the troopers. And again, that's reprioritized. That's no new additional people. And I like to hammer on that because I really think it's important that I think that we have really tried to do an honest, sincere job. We recognize that after the Hansen case, where this fellow who was killing these girls over a long period of time, that we had to try and make a better attempt. Missing persons have been basically a misoperation with police departments, because if someone comes into the Fairbanks Police Department, gee, my son was up here last year, can you find him? Well, where do we look? What do we do? We tried to centralize that. Now we've got pretty good cooperation from the police departments. It's basically in its infancy stages, but we are developing a program that I think is going to be within a year, a bona fide missing persons bureau. We're starting to put out flyers, we're starting to work with the chiefs, we're getting everybody thinking, let's do a little bit more. Would fingerprints help the juveniles? Yeah, that would probably help. I'm not so sure that we would be in a position to retain those fingerprints. So who would take them? There's a lot of logistics that I can see. As far as taking them, as far as the comparisons, we've got that new fingerprint computer system. and that may be an area we could store. Everything is being computerized now. The potential is probably there. I'd have to think a little bit more about the nuts and bolts of that operation before I could really give you a definitive answer, but with the new computer that we have, there's a good possibility that we can incorporate some of this type of stuff into that.
The reason I raised the question, we were informed in the Hess Committee the other day of a child that had been taken into custody by the state of Alaska. That child had been placed in a foster home. And after the child had been in the foster home in excess of 1 year, we then discovered that the child had been kidnapped and that people all over the United States were searching for that child. And it just seemed to me that if there was some format available where a fingerprinting process did occur, that we would have been alerted to that fact a long time before that, and that boy and his family would not have gone through the tremendous agonies that they went through during that period. I've also been informed that, and I've checked this out a bit, this committee last year passed a bill to provide some specific authority and intent for this state and its enforcement officers to assist in apprehending runaway children and restoring them to their parents, and that was vetoed by the governor. I'd like your comments on that, too.
I'm not sure, Commissioner, maybe you can help me out there. I don't know enough about that bill to comment. I don't.
The police departments in Alaska, up until the enactment of, or the repeal of a runaway bill, used to search out and actually put juveniles who had run away from their homes in custody up until, you know, the system would take care of them. In about 1990, I would say in the 70s, sometime maybe in 69, there was a repealer there that a runaway certainly shouldn't be locked up. You know, we should be concerned about the runaway, but the extent of law enforcement's authority there was to locate and advise. We finally got to the point that if the child didn't want to go back home, the only thing we'd assure is that the kid wasn't, you know, being abused or anything. Now it's coming full circle again, you know, that the police, the legislation that the governor vetoed. I still think there's a theory on the part of the social workers anyway that to force a child back into a environment that they run away from, you shouldn't do it. I guess that's one of the theories behind not picking them up and forcing them to go home or forcing them into a lockup. So that's the whole theory behind, you know, the veto, you know, probability. But one of the main theories behind the police not picking them up, locking them up for forcing them to go home is because the kid might have run away from the situation worse than what he's in right now. That was one of the theories. That's about the best I can do.
I appreciate it.
Representative Brunberg?
Colonel, I know the Attorney General is going to introduce a little RICO Act. What steps are you taking to prepare to enforce that?
Before you answer that, would you translate RICO?
Yes.
What did you say?
It's racketeering and organized crime.
Oh, of course. Do it all the time.
RICO Riccardi, huh?
I thought it was a new Italian.
Okay.
Sting operation?
I'm not limiting my question, sir, to the RICO Act. My question is broader than that. And if, you know, that's not the focus. My real question is, what steps are you and your department, your division, taking to go after organized crime in this state? How big a problem do you see it being in the near future?
Well, you know, I guess that if you're talking about the organized crime such as, let's say, the mafia, so to speak, which everyone assumes is a big...
I'm not talking about organized drug crime, because you touched on that. I'm talking about everything from slot machines to prostitution to gambling, the mafia kind of crime, laundering money.
Okay, we have a white-collar crime unit that, and an intelligence section within that white-collar crime unit that has been fairly active as far as some of the liquor license violations. There have been some big-named operatives out of the Seattle area that we were very successful in closing down their operations here with the Department of Revenue. We recently met with some outside, some agents from other states that have expressed an interest in these type of individuals, and they were very impressed with the amount of work that our organized crime unit, well, not organized, our white-collar crime unit, had done in developing this information. So I think that we take those cases basically as they come along. We don't have an organized crime unit per se. We do have an intelligence section. We do work those cases under the white-collar crime unit. And if we do go into a RICO situation, we may have to modify and identify some additional tasks for individuals. But I feel pretty comfortable that the state troopers have a pretty good handle on where we stand with organizations and with this type of activity today.
How big a problem is it?
I don't believe it's anything approaching what everyone would assume it is. I don't think it's that big of a problem. I think certainly anytime you have crime at all, it's a problem. So I'm not trying to minimize it. But I think that for the most part, I think it's something that we have a control on. I think we have knowledge of what's going on. I don't think we're getting blindsided, so to speak. And some of the investigations, unfortunately, they take a great deal of time and effort. So you don't see the instant results where you arrest the guy today because he broke a window and nobody can see that. But I just don't think that those type of cases are something that you're going to see instantaneous results. A lot of it is monitoring, waiting for the right time, waiting for the right set of circumstances to be able to develop something.
Do you think there's a need for a little RICO?
Well, I think we do. Yeah, I think we can do that.
Thank you.
Representative Sun?
And in terms of your intelligence gathering procedures, what are the parameters or on whom do you gather intelligence and what do you do with it once you got it?
Okay, well, there's various areas that we have certainly streamlined intelligence from the old days, so to speak, because it was, I think, probably the Vietnam era certainly brought out the intelligence files and all the negative connotations. Our narcotics intelligence file basically deals with dealers. We're part of the Western States Information Network, which is a composite of all the California, Oregon, Washington, Hawaii, and Alaska, which tries to exchange information on known dealers. If we have new people set up in town, come into town, we get some of our street operatives start telling us, well, hey, Joe Smith is in town. We have a place where we can start checking. What we have done as well is set up through our statewide narcotics bureau in Anchorage, kind of a resource house for let's say the Burbank Police Department call up and say, hey, what do you got on this guy? Or what have you ever heard of him? I mean, we never have heard of him, but those are the types of things. We have the Attorney General's office comes in once a year, reviews our files to see they're in compliance with all existing policies and procedures set up by the Attorney General. So we have certainly, we don't maintain newsy files, we don't maintain all the sinister connotations that used to be developed. And we're primarily dealing now in the white collar area that I addressed earlier, some of the Bunkle squad. The guys that we know are coming in here selling screen doors and are never coming back type of deals. And so those are the types of files we have. But we do have a review by the Attorney General to see that we are in compliance. In fact, when we started developing our narcotics intelligence, really streamlining it, we had them involved. We have a staff attorney from the Attorney General's office to come in and take a look at them and see that we're in compliance. He made a few minor suggestions to us. We followed them and we think we're in pretty good shape.
Madam Chairman, in terms of compliance, are those outlines or parameters or however you gathered that, is that some in-house deal or is that something that DHA developed?
This was established by the Attorney General's office.
Do you know what guidelines they used to establish it, or is it just something some AG sat down and drafted up, or some legislative parameters that...
Well, I would suspect that, I can get you a more definitive answer. I know I can't tell you what they did, but I'm certain that... was probably a result of inquiries with other states that have been challenged in court.
Was it by regulation, so that the public can know about it?
I don't believe it is. I could be wrong, and my best probably answer would be I don't know, but I can find out.
Representative Boucher, did you have a question?
Colonel, you said you had 236 positions, is that correct? 300, yes. Okay. What percentage of those or numbers are actually administrative?
Well, there's a lot less than there was 2 years ago.
What is that?
Okay, I'll tell you what I have here.
Is that I believe I had investigated judicial narcotics.
See, we broke down in this particular handout. I'll tell you, we have one colonel, one lieutenant colonel, two majors, six captains. We've got 14 lieutenants and 15 first sergeants. And that's basically our administrative people. Now, some of these lieutenants are working investigators as well, running up units. The one is general here. This fellow is not only administrator.
Beg pardon?
About 10%.
Yeah, well, probably about 10%. And again, this book will give you a breakdown as to what we're talking about. The sergeants can be both investigators, so you, just by looking at the numbers, well, we're probably in the ballpark.
10%,
isn't it? Okay. Ballpark, yeah.
Okay.
Do you have those reports?
Yes,
a lot of these questions we're asking are probably in there.
Yeah, and I thought that it might be beneficial if you want to look down, because I know you might have some questions later that the staff worked together. I'm real proud of this product, and I thought it might be beneficial for you to get
eight copies.
Yes.
One more question from Mr. Groom, Representative Groomberg, and one more from Representative Taylor. I'm going to bless you on the question.
I'm as well as being concerned about RICO and organized crime, the governor's just recently introduced a bill on unfair business practices. And that's, I think, a very serious problem, at least in Anchorage and the business community. And this isn't exactly a question, but just a comment.
Mm-hmm.
With particular respect to the chairman here, I hope that our committee will deal with these problems when they arise, and I would welcome your testimony at that time with a really good, careful examination of these statutes, whether they look like they're enforceable to you, whether they look like what you'll need to really gear up in these areas, which are more sophisticated crime kinds of areas. And I look forward to having your testimony and helping out.
Well, we'll be glad to, you know, we're glad you take a beck and call, so if you tell us anything we can help you out, we'd be glad to.
We're here to help you.
Okay.
Representative Taylor?
Yes, 49 other states have a conspiracy law on the books. Alaska does not have. Would you comment on that, please?
I think that's probably the first comment that whenever we talk to officers that come up here from outside on investigations, we don't have one. And, most of the seasoned police officers, most of the investigators will tell you that it's been a very, very limiting as far as what we can do with what we know versus what actually has to take place before you can make a case. I think that probably the law enforcement community would support the drafting of some type of conspiracy statute. I think it would help us in many of our investigations that now we have to basically wait for something over to happen before we can actually do something, and reaction, so to speak. We feel that it would give us a lot better tool, I believe, in some of these really sophisticated, complex investigations. It seems to be able to be a key to develop some of these cases, and we just don't have it. So we've worked around it for years. The commissioner's been a case officer about twice as long as I have. I think he was up here when first horse came through, maybe he could elaborate with some of the things he was
saying. Well, is that part?
The first what came through?
But at least he seemed like he had when I first met him.
Has the department recommended this to the governor or attorney general for their submission?
Commissioner Sunberg?
Yes, respond to that.
No draft legislation has originated from the Department of Public Safety to the Attorney General in reference to conspiracy laws. We've talked about it and have favored it for years in the police community in Alaska. We thought conspiracy laws would be of benefit to law enforcement in the state, but I personally haven't drafted. The RICO statute is sort of a mini conspiracy statute, is what we're talking about right now, and we talked that over the Criminal Justice Operating Group with each once a month, but the chairman showed up last time. And I think weighing out the success or lack of success we've had over the years with conspiracy, I think RICO seemed to be the best way to go this year. To answer your question, sir.
Any more questions?
I got cut off some time ago trying to follow up with a juvenile runaway problem. Is it true that the department's policy and policy manual, in fact, today says, if my kid runs away and he's 15 years of age and I tell you I want my kid picked up, that you go talk to the kid, and if the kid doesn't want to come home, you walk away?
he doesn't want to come home, you know, we can't bring him home.
And so Health and Social Services does the same thing.
I think the commission alluded that we have really went full circle, yeah, yeah. Depending upon what the mood, you know, the times were.
Just built for it.
And the thought being that maybe the home environment is bad. Now, maybe that means one out of 100 cases, maybe that way. I mean, the other kid, but we're not empowered to do that anymore.
Colonel, even if you get an inquiry of somebody wants to have you help locate, you can't even do that.
Locating is one thing, but being able to take the child back to his parents, in the example that President Taylor mentioned, we can't say, okay, you're going home, kid. He said, I don't want to go home. And we have no power to bring him home.
Well, I need to talk with you because I had a complaint from a constituent who said that she got no help from the troopers, and we finally got the FBI. I don't want to bring it up here.
Yeah.
She was refused assistance to try to locate a child who was 15 years old. This is in Anchorage.
I think we'll get a deal
for you. I got a deal for you.
We'll talk about
it. I think there's a breakdown of communication. His officer will locate the child and ask the child, but his officer isn't going to necessarily tell the parent where he found the child or that the child is still at that location, so it wouldn't do your constituent a bit of good.
Well, would have at least satisfied her mind that the child was alive. Couldn't they even say that?
Well, I have about 5 cases of people willing to testify on them where they're talking about young juvenile girls in the company of men older than 25 that are heading south out of town on a plane, and you can't even get anybody to stop them at the airport. And I'll guarantee, I don't know what the home situation is like, but the pimps in L.A. going to love her when she gets there.
I have a similar bill on that subject.
Before I adjourn the meeting, I'm on the record to show that representatives Taylor, Grunberg, Son, Phillips, Teddy John, and Representative Vouchers are present.
For most of the meeting. Thank you.
Have you just adjourned?
Mm-hmm.
I also wish to be excused for money.
Committee?
I'm sorry. Yep.
You mean Phillips?
If you just notice.
Right. You don't do that. You just go.
Well, it was good to say it the last time you were here. We started with Jason Kramer.